Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, Gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
And we have a special guest.
Yes, we do.
And we have been covering a series that we are on part three of, the Lake House Murder.
Fire series.
And we promised you the best guest ever.
Right. And so, would you introduce yourself?
Absolutely.
Introduce yourself.
Yes. Christine Tillman, an attorney that works for Eric Gayward Andrew Lawyers. Yep. And
shout out to Eric
Gayward. Eric Gayward.
The E Guarantee. That's right.
Hey, where'd you go to law school?
Southern University. Right.
You know, my aunt was tenured there for 30-something years until she died.
Really?
Cynthia Piku.
I've heard of Piku. Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of outlines for
everybody.
Piku.
Everybody heard of her. She was my dad, who was also a lawyer, and my mom was the first woman inducted to LSU Law School. Everybody in my family is a lawyer except for me, six brothers and sisters. But my dad said Cynthia was the most genius legal mind he had ever seen. She could write backwards with two hands on the chalkboard and that kind of, but she was out there, like if she would meet you, there's no social skills, you know. And she'd meet you, and like if she thought you were fat, and she'd say, "I'm Cynthia, and you're fat." God rest her soul, she's my aunt.
So. Yeah.
And then my godmother, my mom's other sister, is Sydney Walker, the judge in East West Feliciana now.
Yeah. Oh wow!
So
You have a lot of full family of attorneys, and that's what I was telling Jim the other day is I'm the only one in my family, but I had three brothers total in law enforcement at one time. Two were currently still in law enforcement.
Shout out to
him. Yeah, and then my husband at one time was in corrections.
Right.
His daddy was a retired warden.
Right.
So a little different on the opposite end.
Yeah. So mine is exact opposite. All my brothers and sisters, and both of my grandfathers, one was a judge until he died, one was longest running DA in the state, and then one of my grandmothers became a lawyer also, and then my mom and my dad and all my brothers and sisters.
Wow.
And here I am sitting across the table from you.
That's it. It's funny how life works.
So let's tell the reason you're here today is you have a lot of intimate knowledge on the series we've been doing and how this came about. So we're going to give the listeners the inside scoop from that you're never going to get anywhere else.
Absolutely.
Deal?
That's right. And just to tell them how we came in contact. So it was funny. You reached out to me and you're like, you have a podcast. And this was just recently. Ms. Tillman and I knew each other because in my former life as I managed a large paint corporation that was family owned, and she's a real estate agent. I think you still have your license and all that sort of thing.
Yes, so I have a couple listings, and I actually work for Mandy Benton Realty down the road.
Yeah, there you go.
So shout out to them.
And was showing us some commercial buildings, and that's kind of how we met. And then many years later, she discovers this podcast, and she's like, how did I not know? That's right. But glad you're here, and you do have some knowledge on this, and maybe kind of start with your particular knowledge with this case and pretty landmark decision that was made.
It very, very interesting case. I was actually I was at the First Circuit at the time working under Judge Terrio.
Yep.
With the First Circuit Court of Appeal, which is located in Baton Rouge.
Right.
And I remember because, you know, when you clerk for a judge and the judge, they get writs all the time.
Yeah.
You know, basically requesting, you know, it's not an appeal of right. It's just saying, please take my case.
Yeah. And a writ is essentially a letter of sorts from someone appealing a case. Is that
exactly
typically
because
what that
if is? They what people often do is when you don't have the right to appeal or your time has lapsed for an appeal, they take on a writ of certiorari.
Gotcha.
So this was the case here, and it was Attorney General at the time, Landry, or you know, Governor elect.
Yes.
That had submitted
Shout
the writ.
Out.
And now, there was a lot of discussion of which I can't disclose exactly, you know, what took place in the background with all the judges and everything, but he had submitted a
writ. Oh, it's just us talking here.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's going to hear this one.
A few hundred thousand listeners.
Yeah.
But I remember my first impression was when he originally submitted it was what happened that he wouldn't attach what he had needed to attach to the writ. And I read it and I said, wow.
Yeah.
This is absolutely something.
Yeah.
Huge. And while I'd had it, I remember researching and pulling up various decisions and a prior law that was very similar that was also shut down by the Supreme Court. And I remember pulling up a case, I believe it was Reddick case. And not a lot of people pay attention to the footnotes.
Yeah. But you do.
The Supreme Court is very important.
Yeah.
Because they issue directives and they'll tell you what they want or what you need to do, so on and so forth. And I remember looking at a footnote in that particular case, and they'd brought up the particular law that, you know, Landry was actually challenging at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh my goodness, if this goes to the Supreme Court, they're going to shut it down.
Yeah.
Just based on that footnote and the application of the law. And what I thought to myself is it's not necessarily the application that has been so far, like, you know, with Montgomery and various people, them using it. I don't necessarily think kind of on the line, but it's how the law is written and how it can be used, not how it has been used. Because it can be abused based on the language and provide more than what has been provided.
Yes.
People.
And you referenced Montgomery, and for you listeners out there, correct me if I'm wrong, but Montgomery is where a minor, someone under the age of 18 was convicted for life in prison with no possibility of parole. And then they changed that decision and said, if you were convicted as a minor, that you basically you had to have a chance at parole after a certain time period. That's what Montgomery is for the listeners out there that may not be familiar. For people that
are juveniles that were convicted second-degree murder, sentenced to life without the possibility, and they came later on, they changed it where they had at least a shot.
And for you listeners out there, we actually had the first guy that was released in Louisiana.
On the show, we sure did.
Yeah. It was a very, very good episode, and the guy's doing good things now with his release, but...
I'm sorry to interrupt. For the listeners, I just want them to understand when you say you're clerking, that doesn't mean you're a secretary. You're actually, the clerks are really the ones that the judges don't have time to read all of the legalese and
find the precedents.
So you're actually doing the meat of the work and you bring it to their attention and say, holy smokes, we got something.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And that's how important with precedent, you know, anytime you're dealing with the law and especially appeals and things like that, you go back and you see how other judges have ruled. And that's why precedent is so important, because when you set a precedent, you're doing just that. You're basically saying, you know, we ruled this certain way. And so attorneys will reference that to say, this is why we think this guy should go to jail or not go to jail, or, you know, all kinds of legalese, you know, the gamut of the law. So,
well, I think also what is important is to know your judges.
Yeah.
And because a lot of them do set them a pattern in their rulings, and not just with the rulings, but also, you know, personally their background.
Yeah.
Right.
And what they've done in the past. You know, I think that's very important too.
Absolutely. And you'll see it even when they, go to Congress. A lot of times you can watch congressional hearings, and if you're a nerd like me, you actually watch those, and they're entertaining, to say the least. But you will see people going for judgeships, and even Supreme Court, people nominated the Supreme Court, and they will grill them on rulings. You ruled this way to try to, I guess, show if they're showing favoritism towards, you know, if they're a Democrat and a lot of their policies are whatever.
Judges are human beings too. I'm not going to say I never judge shop to get a warrant signed or whatever. who I could take it to and get it done.
Yeah, good point.
Who might question it. So.
Yeah. So you're doing that. You're digging through this. You find something and you're like,
Yeah, and the first thing that came to my mind is Chief Justice Wehmer. I thought to myself, just knowing his background, I believe he was a professor, instructor, I believe, for about 16 years.
Yeah.
An independent, seems fair, straight down the line, but he's all about the rules.
Right,
yeah.
He ate them up in his language from, this is wrong, and it was wrong here. And he put significant details in there.
Yeah.
But that was one prediction I thought, you know, when I saw everything, just thinking about the various justices that were there. Now, I wasn't aware that Hughes would have to recuse himself in that instance. I wasn't too familiar with the other judge that went in, but I remember you guys talking about him in part two.
Yeah.
That sat in for Hughes after the recusal. So,
right. Why did Hughes recuse himself?
That I do not know why he recused himself, but I'm sure there are various reasons why judges do recuse themselves. So I can only assume there may have been a personal relationship or prior representation or, you know, something along those
maybe
lines.
Maybe he sentenced him.
Could have been a
relative
to somebody. Various reasons.
Yeah, very good. And so when you recuse yourself, it just takes any look of impropriety out of the equation.
At the end of the day, judges don't want their stuff reversed, right?
Yeah.
Especially, you know, somebody comes up and says, oh, well, you knew such and such, and you got personal bias in this, et cetera, and get it reversed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
So after researching the case, well, after he had submitted the first writ for review, you know, missing the documentation, so on and so forth, that the second writ that he, you know, submitted was untimely. But in the interim, you know, any writ that you receive, you want to see both sides. Right. So you're digging through the record, you're doing your research, you're looking at prior decisions, you're trying to find any jurisprudence there, prior laws that were similar. So that's primarily what I did. And I wouldn't necessarily say issue reports, but like, you know, type of a memorandum you get with the other clerks, you discuss everything, you get with the judges and you discuss everything. Right. So even whether it's going to be taken up or not, there are still discussions as to the particular case. And that's what, you know, of course, happened in this case. Because although, you know, a judge may not read everything in the record and every single detail, and sometimes they do. I was surprised how much work they did and how much they actually researched and read, especially on a constitutional issue. But I think it was very wise that the less you say, the better. So in these circumstances, I mean, the circumstances then was, you know, just not any reasons, not any directive, no comment on the constitutionality of the law. You know, they just went straight procedure. And I think that was wise for them to do that, for an appellate court to get overturned. They don't want to get overturned.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. They, at the end of the day, they don't want to be.
They would rather just say,
wants that loss. Yeah.
Denied. I have, you know, my reasons. Let it go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So, like I said, being surprised that all that took place with that, I thought, good Lord, Landry, of all people, what happened here? Mm-hmm. But I'm sure he had assistants working for him, and they just maybe misstep, dropped the ball. Something happened, and it's
and it was really a technicality more than any, I mean, it was the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the primary issue was the lateness. You have so many days or something to turn this writ in.
30 days.
Yeah, and it was just later than that. So it wasn't, you're not right in what you're saying. You just didn't get it to us in time, basically. Wow. Yeah,
and that, there's a reason they have that time frame.
Which
like,
is?
And I'm just,
oh,
for whatever. No, no, for whatever. Baby, I'm talking about like people that I have, Ashley Posey, for instance, second degree murder convicted, and they have a, I think, a year or whatever to file their appeal in, and she filed it late.
Well,
and like, you got nothing else to do. But I don't know why, what happened in AG's office. Like she said, maybe somebody did whatever, but they didn't get filed, But, which also makes this case unique because it still got it proceeded.
That's right. And you have a right to a speedy trial. And I think maybe that's some of it, or and speedy decisions, and
back in her case, she was already convicted.
Yeah,
everybody has the right to appeal unless you plea bargain
out
for your sentence. So back to it, it's late.
It's late,
but it still got to take out.
Exactly, and that is one question I've asked myself. You know, the thoughts of the justices, you know, taking this up because it was a 4-3 decision.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, had Hughes not been recused, what the decision may have been.
Mm.
But with Landry, was Landry given an exception with the procedural hurdles? Somebody in a different seat, Joe Blow down the road, filing it untimely, would the Supreme Court have taken it up?
The same leeway, if you will. Yeah.
So I didn't see the language in the interest of justice, but they do have that right in the interest of justice to take it up despite the procedural hurdles.
Yeah.
So that was what I kind of settled with. Whether I agree with it or not, I'm kind of on the fence.
Right.
As to that,
but yeah, that's, you know, ultimately that's their decision.
Exactly,
and they have to answer for it.
Exactly. Right? So if I put myself in Landry's shoes, if I believe something was unconstitutional, I don't care if it's late or not, I'm gonna file it.
Absolutely.
And I do not blame him, and he did a great job, and it was written very well.
It sure was. Yeah.
Now sitting in a judge's seat, I don't know what I would have done, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So,
and it's important to note. I mean, I think that the question, and you know, why Landry was taking this to the level that it got taken to, was not a question of guilt or innocence. For him, it was a question of constitutionality. You know, whether the guy had done it or not done it, were up to the appeals courts to decide. He had a problem with the constitutionality of a district attorney being able to basically tell a judge, I think that we need to impose a lighter sentence, and that lighter sentence being imposed because in his mind, only a governor has that power. That's clemency, right, in his mind.
And again, for the listeners, this is all after the conviction. Mm-hmm. Never, well, like you said,
right, and
the guy did it, now he's been tried by a jury of his peers, yes, found guilty,
right,
sentenced, and here we are.
And here we are. And
they were going to cut the deal, you know, coming back on it. And Jeff Landry, the attorney general, is like, this is not right.
Yeah. So question for you, Ms. Christine. Once that occurs and this becomes late, your option as the attorney general is to then go up to the Supreme Court level and say, well, I'm going to let them hear this case, exactly, the Supreme, you know, court, and their decision is final at that point.
Yes.
Okay. So it's kind of the last step, and that's what he does.
Yes, that's exactly what he did. And, you know, the Supreme Court, they took up the writ, you know, and as previously stated, a writ is not a right. So
yeah,
it's the discretion of the judges, and they must have seen this to be a very important issue, to address. So they took up the writ, and,
so they have to take it up. They're not
could have declined.
Bound. They can decline. I did not know
that's
that.
That's the difference between, you know, an appeal.
Right.
Now, you know, and you'll have a judgment on that. But with a writ, they don't have to take it up. I did not know that. So,
that's interesting. Well, thankfully they took it up.
I mean, that's what's so significant about this is they didn't have to.
Right. Yeah. So they saw something.
And there. Then also with the dispute as to whether or not he had standing,
mm-hmm,
and then the timeliness, and then them having the discretion to take it up. That is pretty significant.
Yeah.
Well, they saw what I see, or, you know, and it was wrong.
Yeah.
Or ultimately they decided that they couldn't do that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I don't know if you want to talk about it, but do you agree with that decision personally? Maybe. If you were sitting at that level.
I'm kind of on the fence with the decision with the, you know, that particular case. Now, the way the statute is written, do I see it being misused the way it's written? Yes, I could see that. I could see it equating to a pardon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was interesting with the Supreme Court's decision, there was a notation in the footnotes where this was not considered clemency or anything like that. It was considered a pardon, is what the Supreme Court had stated.
Yeah.
Because you're dropping one,
right,
and it's going away.
Yeah.
And then you're giving them something completely new.
Right.
Yeah.
So they equate it to a pardon. Now, I'm not sure if I agree with that or not. Technically, you know, written on paper, I can see it. But how it's treated and what's taking place, you know, kind of, I don't know if I would, that would be my first thought, that it's actually a pardon.
Yeah.
Per se.
Right. And only the governor has pardon power.
Exactly.
Right? Interesting.
And, kind of surprised me in the beginning that the AG would go, basically, they're going against the DAs and the judges, right?
Yes.
But it's the AG's job, and that if he thinks it's wrong, and that, I mean, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. But, you know, normally the powers that be don't go against each other on that. That's what I got out of it.
Yeah, and you make a good point. And when you think you're on the outside of all this, you would think, I mean, they're all maybe friends. And, you know, it's a situation for him. You bring up a good point to step out and just say, hey, I don't think what y'all are doing here is constitutionally acceptable. Pretty big step from man. And for those that are not familiar with or don't live in Louisiana, we have listeners all over the world. Jeff Landry is a very constitutional person, and we love him for that. And he is now the governor elect for the state of Louisiana. At this time, he was the attorney general, and he did a lot of fighting, you know, and of what he believed in, and I credit him a lot for that. And this was one thing that he just didn't like the way it looked, the optics of it, and apparently he was right.
Exactly.
You know, when the Supreme Court made that decision, my question, and I think Woody actually brought this up in his divine wisdom, is so you have guys that are exonerated on DNA, for example, and they get exonerated on that DNA and they get released from prison. And it's not necessarily the governor that's releasing them. What, I guess, do you remember having that conversation with me? So what your question on that was?
My statement on it was DNA is the evidence in the DNA is irrefutable. Like one in 100 trillion, whatever it may be. So they have to take a look at that.
Yeah.
In this case, this guy was tried and convicted and sentenced, and it wasn't on DNA. They're not challenging the DNA in the case.
They're not challenging the Senate. They're not challenging the guilt or innocence.
In the case, when they come back later, years later, it just happened to have the brain, and you know, they're saying it's MS, could be MS. That's why she tripped and fell. And I was like, the pathologist didn't see that in the beginning. The first thing they take out is the brain and look at it, and then even the defense pathologist didn't see it. And then all these years later, some other doctor sees it, and that's not DNA exclusion. It's a hypothetical. Oh, she could have tripped and fell because of this. And then instead of going back and fighting it in court, reopening old wounds and whatever, they made the decision that, hey, you know what? Give them credit time for sir, drop from second degree to manslaughter or whatever it was, and let him out. Or give him the chance for the clemency hearing, what have you. And that's where the fight came in. I mean, that's the difference. If DNA or it's something else, a video comes up, something that's irrefutable. This wasn't irrefutable. This is like kind of, I don't want to say they were trying to just make it go away, but they didn't want to have that fight again. And he'd been down for however long.
Yeah.
So.
See, what I find interesting, and I absolutely agree with you with DNA. And now for post conviction relief, you actually have a 2-year time frame to actually go for it. But there are exceptions, and that includes the DNA. But with just the brain, I don't think that would fall under that particular exception. Right. But there was a note in one of the dissenting opinions, I forgot which it may have been Justice.
It didn't matter.
Yeah. But there was a good point there, and they were actually, it seemed to be directing Lee as to what to do because this has fallen through. There's something referred to as factual innocence, and it can be anywhere from DNA to testimony to, you know, it's scientific, it's forensic, so on and so forth. That's one of the exceptions to the 2 years. And I noticed in the dissent they had brought that up saying, hey, you know, even though we're taking this law away, you have to fall under this particular statute for these exceptions, one of which is this. And it has to be clear and convincing, present it, you have the brain, and then they discuss the white plaque, so on and so forth. It was almost as if knowing he's going to read it to assist, hey, you can do this, you know. This isn't the end of the world.
Right.
You know, you have time to present your case.
And again, they missed it. Both sides missed it in the beginning, whatever. And now I agree with you on, you know, I don't want anybody innocent sitting in prison, but they come back to look at it. that's where I think they came to the agreement today. It was like, you know what? This is could be plausible. So let's just, I mean, he's been down for 28 years or however long.
It was about that long.
Instead of doing this over again, that's a significant amount of time. Let's do this. And which ended up being in violation.
Well, and you know, we brought up the brain, and here's the question. Look, my wife asked me this question. I'm like, I don't know. But why did they keep the brain? I can never really find strange. The answer to that question.
I'm going to tell you, and you can correct me or say whatever you want to say when I get done. The deal is, every autopsy I've ever been to, they wring your face out, pull it over, pop your skull first, take the brain out, they weigh it. And every significant organ, if there's even a question, they make sure it's not diseased. An autopsy is a process of elimination, right? And so,
like an investigation.
You're right. And then, I mean, obviously, if you get down and you have a gunshot wound, and then they'll trace or whatever.
Sure.
But when they take the brain out, they're going to weigh it. If they don't find any abnormalities, and even sometimes if they think there might be something that gets tied to it, they'll just take a slice of it. And preserve that slice. I found it so strange in this case that they had the brain after all these years. I'm like, what's the chain of custody on that? Who's to say it wasn't some grandma's brain that got swapped over or whatever? I mean, obviously, they must have had it locked down somewhere. Chain of custody.
Well, it really is. And I could never find it. My wife asked me that question, and she's like, I mean, if that's my relative, I want to bury them with their brain. Yeah. That's just her.
But the organs, believe it or not, and they put them in the bag, put them inside a thing, and sew it up. I don't know how that brain got kept. Unless this person was an organ donor or something, and they were going to save it for testing. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
To be honest with you, I have no idea. When I found out the brain was preserved in formaldehyde, I'm thinking to myself, the whole brain?
Yeah, right.
Slides.
Yeah, slides are the most I've ever seen. Unless the brain was part of like subdural hematomas, unless it was part of the cause of what they're saying the homicide was for. And I still can't imagine keeping it for 28 plus years or however long it was. I was like...
That blew my mind because I cannot. So if anybody's out there listening, that's the answer. Please tell us.
They're paying, as taxpayers, we're paying rent for that brain to sit in a closet somewhere for all those years.
Well, and you know, that was a big basis of them trying to get a new trial, a big basis of convincing the district attorney to go to a judge and say, hey, we need to knock this sentence down, is because they said that she, Miss Audra Bland, had MS that she was unaware of, and that would explain her falling very easily.
Hindsight's 20/20. After all these years, these other pathologists missed it, including the fence pathologists. They missed it in the beginning. How does someone see the plaque and all this that should have been something from my point.
How did two people miss it?
On opposing sides, right? And they both miss it and all these years later. But back to it, I think, again, I'm not throwing shade on the DA or anybody else. Had I been in this position after all these years, I'd be like, oh, shit, this might go up and they might, say retried and I'm going to have to do this and spend all this money. And, this guy's been down. Give them his out, right? Or knock it down. But where they got screwed is coming back, and the DA's like, I don't want this to go back up and then have to spend all these resources when this guy's been down for a long time. Now, I don't know about her family or anything else or living victims, but a lot of times what happened in cases, people on especially on appeal and stuff like that, or parole hearings and things like that. If the victim's family doesn't show up or stuff, if there's no one to call us an ape, an acute political emergency is what we used to call it, or raise a stink, then they'll just be like, you know what? It's pretty reasonable. He's been down. It's not reasonable to me as a homicide detective. Sure. I believe you kill somebody and you get sentenced to life, you should die in prison. But the DA's like, I don't really want to spend my time and resources. I got other shit to do.
Yeah.
Pass it on.
Yeah. and you know, avoid the possibility of a retry and a loss.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I really think that that is a viable option and probably should be. I don't think the DA is, and none of the DAs, and I've worked with most of them, that I don't think they would come from a really bad place, but I'm sure, you know, there's good and bad in every profession. I think that should almost be a tool that maybe they should look at changing the rule on, you know, where on something like that, when new evidence comes forward and yeah, the DA, this DA didn't live this case, but his office lived the case. They had the case files and the detectives probably were dead. It might've been a lot of different things. The DA's like, I can't get the witnesses. There's no family left. The detectives are dead, whatever. I don't want to have to fight this fight, but I could see in other cases, whether it's DNA or whatever, eyewitness testimony, whatever comes back bad, if they have the discretion and go to a judge and the judge agrees with it, I almost think they should be able to do that. Yeah. But I understand the Constitution is what it is. The law is what it is. So I do not disagree with Jeff Landry at all on now.
That's right.
But every rule that's been in any policy and procedure manner that's ever been written is because somebody screwed something up.
Yeah.
Well, to comment on what you just stated, I can see where you're coming from, and I do agree. I think where there may be an issue is this, what is individualized as opposed to just a general set rule.
Right, right.
So under Article 930.3, there's all of the reasons delineated there as to post-conviction relief. Right. And how it can be granted, including the DNA and the factual innocence or right. what have you. But under the law at issue, it basically says, okay, one person, we all come together, we're going to discuss this, and then we're going to reach an agreement.
Right.
So I think that might have been an issue with it and how yeah. it was written and maybe providing too much discretion.
Yeah.
And and the reason why I state that is not to say I believe that. That was another comment I'd seen in a different right. opinion as to it being individualized as opposed to the legislature creating an additional ground
right.
that says if you have no family, if you have this, if you have this, and then it applies to everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
So, as opposed to this one person.
I'm going to go back on that.
Good point.
Two things on what you said. I agree. If they go back and they change it, it needs to apply to everyone, right? And not just in an individual case. Everyone should have that option. Now, is that going to screw up the legal system more and make things drag out and appeals, whatever it may be? And I'm not saying that, you know, I love both sides of it kind of because, I mean, you know, I don't believe even one innocent should sit inside. And a lot of times people will have stuff come forward past 6 9, I don't know the legalese, and they're like, they're just screwed. It's outside the time frames and whatever. And I'm like, holy smokes, you know, this. But I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, it's.
I probably, you know, I stay awake a lot. Not awake, but it bothers me sometimes. And late at night when I'm thinking about it, and I just pray when I read about some of these cases that I never put anybody in gold for the rest of their life. And then that I got it wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, your intention was right, always.
Right, right. But it doesn't mean that, you know, the worst testimony in the world is eyewitness testimony, right? And,
yeah.
and stuff like that. But I don't know. I don't know what the answer
well,
is.
Well, and you do personal injury, and in your profession, he just brought up eyewitness testimony, and that's something in a wreck, you know, and you have people see that wreck. It's not very eyewitness testimony is not very reliable because, you know, in a lot of different levels, not only from, you know, murder and major criminal issues, but even from something as not as simple as a wreck, because some are absolutely horrible, but something like a wreck where you're gathering witnesses and you got two people that were in the same place at the same time and saw two different things, right?
Let's touch on it real quick. You could have five people, and generally you ask them, and they're going to, and they might give you a different description of a shirt or height or weight or what they guess the age is. As long as they get the base same thing.
Yeah.
Now, some eyewitnesses just lie.
Yeah.
For whatever reason and stuff like that. And that's when that's found out is where the real issue comes in. And you're almost never, you know, you could put all of us in a room and a gunman comes in and does whatever and starts capping off rounds and leaves. We're almost never going to give the same description.
Yeah.
Right? But we could all agree to the base of it. But even on personal injury cases, shit, certainly there's a reason some people are going to lie on both sides. But that's just the nature of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. But a major decision nonetheless and historic. And it, you know, you were the one that she texted me and she says, I can't believe that y'all haven't covered this yet. No,
I was like, am I crazy? And I went back through and I'm looking, I said, there's no way they missed this in September. There's no way.
Well, and that huge value to, we love it and encourage all of the listeners to reach out if you have something you'd like us to talk about, because this is one, it became a 3-part series. Had you not reached out, it may have slipped through the cracks for who knows how long before we picked it up and right. caught it.
Right. I'm telling you, we would have never picked it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we may have found it at one point.
Dated on play.
Pretty cool. That's right. Yeah. Dated on play and dated on lie, right?
That's right. That's right.
So ultimately, this is, I mean, I'd say to sum it up, but you brought it to the forefront. And they ran with it, and it was 4-3 decision.
4-3, and see, I really am torn on it. Reading through the record, and I'm kind of happy that they preserved the brand, because you don't want somebody innocent,
right?
Staying in,
yeah, no, you know, absolutely. Not. Nobody wants that.
So I would like to see, you know, something come of this, because after reading through the record, I was dumbfounded that it was at a hearing for a joint motion wherein the husband actually stated that Bland was prone to fall and suffer with dizziness.
And I'm like, why didn't the defense, why didn't the defense get that out in the beginning? And why didn't their pathologist look at the brain then? Oh, holy shit, if she's prone to falling, it could be EMS or whatever.
I'd like to see it go back to trial.
Yeah. Well, again, but like then back to the DA side, on the cases like that, and they're like, you know what? Maybe these witnesses aren't live. Maybe this wasn't preserved. Maybe whatever. And then I got to explain why our pathologist didn't pick this up in the beginning and what have you.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. I forgot what expert it was, but it was the one that actually discovered the white plaque or what have you on the brain, saying it was indicative of the multiple sclerosis. Right. Well, the coroner, as well as another expert, couldn't disagree.
Right.
Right.
But after, you know, Googling, because I'm not a doctor, you know, Googling a little bit, there are other causes for that. So I would actually like to see the brain tested.
Right.
And to see if that is,
you
know, and see why not go back to trial.
Yeah. You think they'll go back to trial?
This, I don't know, because what I don't understand is why was there only a visual inspection by that expert and not actual testing of the brain? Maybe they were trying to get a new trial based on some kind of reasonable doubt, reaching for straws.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe because you didn't find what Jeff Landry's people sent in the writ. Maybe they were just hoping to get this agreement, right? Well, you know what? Bring enough pressure. They didn't want to go to trial. Well, we really don't want to go to trial, but we're not telling them that. And maybe we can reach this agreement. And guess what? It backfired.
Yeah.
Because now they're never getting that agreement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow. Like crazy.
Thank you for giving us that case to cover.
I could talk about it all day. There's so much
thousands
here, like y'all
of
said.
Downloads. Yeah, that we've gotten on this thing. Yeah. What intrigued you the most about this case?
It was the disputes of, you know, because the justices, when you have, you know, the main opinion, and you had the dissenting opinion, sometimes they write an additional when they're concurring or what have you, is to see them kind of go back and forth at each other.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And I do like that, because I find the Supreme Court is pretty good with that. And I see it with the the state appellate courts or what have you, but not to that extent. So I find it pretty interesting, but everybody needs a Ginsburg and Scalia, right? There's always two sides, but you can be best friends and eat at a, have a dinner.
That's what
I enjoy is them being able to come together, but seeing them go back and forth, but having been in the background working with judges, it's like they're so mean on paper, but then you're sitting there and they're all laughing, drinking coffee.
It's
kind of like attorneys going to trial and they're against each other and they're like, okay, let's go get some coffee now.
Isn't that something?
That's part of it, the practice of law.
That's right. And speaking of that, you're a lawyer now, and how much do you love law?
Hey, what made you want to become a lawyer?
Yeah.
If it's too personal, you don't have to answer.
Oh, no, not too personal. There was an attorney who was a dear friend of mine, Ike Hawkins. I started at his office just like a secretary, just whatever. I was probably 15, 16 years old. And I just got to watch, and then I started doing paralegal work. And I was like, man, I think I'm kind of stuck in this. Right. I say, you know what? And I started really enjoying it, and I said, this is what I want to do.
Right.
And I'm seeing the attorneys do everything, even though it's kind of like the nurse and the doctor. You do everything in the background, attorneys, the one signing, settling, and getting the glory, right? I said, well, I think I can do that. I'd been from law firm to law firm, from managing HR to paralegal work, been around.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get away from it, got a passion for it. And when I was in law school, I was on law review.
Sweet.
I became real fascinated with the legislature and, the bills and, I have a couple of publications of which have been cited, which is pretty cool.
Really?
By the Fourth Circuit. Awesome. Actually, attorneys reach out to me regarding my publications. And they want me to enroll as counsel in some of their
work. To help them.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just all of this, just doing that for such a long time, coupled with my love of writing and justice and reading and finding that loophole somewhere. But in my heart of hearts, I really wanted to be a prosecutor.
Me too.
But my husband told me no.
That's love. I had the grades and everything to go, but I just didn't want to. And not knocking the cry because my whole family does it, sit behind the desk and do the same thing. But I would have been a prosecutor like one of my grandfathers or a judge like my other one, right? I can't sit still long enough.
I love it.
I love it that, you know what? The world needs good attorneys, right?
Yeah, I agree.
And
it is what they keep it, when it, in its purest form, they're keeping everybody honest.
Right.
And everybody, the law is such an important thing. And I dealt with, not super recently, within the last year, one of my kids, someone hit and run them right there on the road. Yeah, ran a red light. And it was a big mess.
It was
on
video, right?
Yeah. Thank God for Good Samaritans in the world. This person I didn't know, and he was from Florida, and he sent his dash cam video into the police of the wreck.
That's awesome.
It just so happened to do that. But long story short, the insurance company that we were dealing with waited till the exact last day to do everything they had to do. And I'm not crushing on all insurance companies, but let me tell you, I didn't like this one. And
I could take a wild guess.
It was an open and shut case, and they fought it tooth and nail just because they could. Yep. And so that's why lawyers are important, and especially personal injury lawyers, because they look out for things like that. Yep. So, shout out to you for following your dreams and, becoming
and owning it.
And owning it.
I'm trying.
And loving the law.
Hey, you have any questions for us?
Yeah. Anything? What's our favorite color?
There's nothing off
green.
The record. Don't ask. Don't ask if you don't want to know the truth.
Yeah, what are you doing? Don't ask him something too crazy. He'll answer it.
I'm just curious how you guys got together.
Oh, that's a great
story. And then how you came to be, I guess, director doing podcasts. podcasts. Yeah. And I kind of heard a little bit of your story when you said, what is a podcast? I was the same way.
Right.
Because I actually had a friend of mine, Meredith Thigpen, tell me about one of your podcasts. And I was like, how do I do
that? Shout out to her.
My husband listens to podcasts, but how do I do that?
I didn't even know. I'd never heard the word.
Yeah, I'm a dinosaur. I'm like, asking my girls, hey, can y'all turn my phone on and get me a podcast that's called this, you know?
Yeah.
So I heard a little bit of the background, but how you guys came to be and, you know, how you got into it.
This is a great story. I got to tell this one. Yeah. So, I was in a whole different world. I was a sales manager for a family-owned paint company, but very successful privately-owned company. It was the largest privately-owned paint company in the United States and been around forever. Very successful with that, 20-plus years, same job, never left. Through that, I wanted to promote my company more and what they were doing. And I started something called Chapman's Paint Place Podcast. And it was horrible as far as video. It was with a cell phone. It was like everything you would expect to be horrible. Yeah. But it had some viewers because I would be like, show me how to touch up a sheetrock wall. I'd be on a painter's job site and they would do it. And people would YouTube how to touch up a sheetrock wall and they'd watch it. So I had a little bit of an audience there. And I always had a passion for private businesses. That's why I worked for a small family-owned paint company relative to like the large Sherwin-Williams of the world for so many years. And I wanted to promote small business and mom and pops and people that were just busting their tails. And so I got in touch with McHugh David of the Livingston Parish News. That's and awesome. He was doing a podcast of his own. And I said, man, I want to rent your studio and do my stuff out of there. I don't know how to edit. I don't know how to do any of that. How much will you charge me? Came up with a price. And I started that. Through that, the guy sitting to my left was the world's greatest podcaster. And he was bigger than life.
By accident, total accident.
But he's, you know, Woody Overton, and this is 2019, and he is on absolute fire. He's everywhere, number one podcast in the world. And I was a fan, right? So I loved his shit, and I would listen to it all the time. And I said, I wonder if I texted him on Facebook and told him to come on Local Leaders if he would do it. Now, I'm totally thinking, there's no way this guy's going to do this. But I sent a text, and I still have it. It was like War and Peace, girl. This thing was nine pages long. Please, you know, I'm like embellishing how successful I am at the podcast. I'm like, yeah, you know, we recorded the Livingston Parish News.
We need to print that up one day and put it hanging on the wall in the studio.
Definitely. I'm going to do that.
For sure.
So I go through this whole begging thing, and I swear the next text I get back is about 5 minutes later. Took him that long to read it. Yeah. So, basically said, Jim, you had me at hello. And he came in and he did Local Leaders. And
this was before Envision was here. This
way that, before. We were filming it.
The Livingston Parish News.
Yes. Wow. And it caught fire because of absolutely of him. I used him for that. And through that process, it was, you know, it's hard to explain. You come across people in your life that you just feel like we're meant to be there. That was kind of like a me and Woody thing. Since that meeting and that podcast, we've never kind of deviated from each other. It's very strange. So through that, God blesses you. We believe this. Right. And things would come up and we would always kind of collaborate. And at one point I made the crazy decision to leave my job that I was totally secure with and go way out on a limb. Right. And it has been probably the best gift other than my children that God has ever given me.
And your wife.
Wow. And my wife, of course. Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Her. That's right. That, too. She goes without saying, hey, I like that. Recovery. You know,
it was just a stupid blessing.
Yeah.
And then, and within 5 months, I started my podcast by accident. I used to travel the country, and I'm certified in all federal courts as a expert witness in law enforcement matters. And nice. So that's what I was doing. That's that and polygraphs at the time. And then, but I started the podcast within 5 months of one People's Choice Podcast of Year Award for Drama and Storytelling, and rolled on, started doing live shows and all this stuff. And then, you know, we hooked up and I told him, I said, hey, you gotta grab them things if you and step out there on faith. Cause I did it. And like when, I started cutting back on my other stuff cause the stuff's taken off and I didn't know anything. Right. Yeah. And had to go through different producers and different things and take learning licks and, you know, improvise, adapt, and overcome. And we put it together. It's kind of like the One in Twin Powers activated. Yeah. Right.
Amen.
And then he stepped out, started Envision Podcast Studios, brought everything over to him. And then we did, you know, obviously, we wanted to do something together. Yeah. And we both love the history. And we both love mafia too.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were going to start mafia. But I have a mad love for Angola. And the history and just putting together and everything else is rolling.
Yeah, one day we sat down and we just said, we're gonna do a podcast on Angola and fire.
And meanwhile, he's producing, you know, my other stuff and people were basically lining up the door. He opened Envision on faith and, you know, people are like showing up, hey, I want to start a podcast. I mean, he provides everything, the editing. He's like, me always trying to get better at what he does, and he's the best I've ever had as far as producer and everything else. And that's not an ass kissing, it's true. But we put it together. Envision now is, you know, has more successful shows than anybody else that I know.
Yeah,
it's certainly in Louisiana, and
100%.
We keep rolling with it, and we have more stuff lined up.
Yeah,
it's coming.
And look for Law with Christine Tillman coming soon.
Yes, Swim is definitely going to not be for the faint hearts.
Yeah, you ain't going to listen to that one. But you are going to want to listen to it. You ain't going to believe it when you listen to it.
Listen after you have a couple of drinks.
Okay. Yeah. We thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, you know
thank
what? You so much You're awesome. But I got to give a shout out to the man in the room, not Jim Chavin. What's your husband's name?
Yes.
Andrew.
Andrew, shout out, bro, for bringing her in this morning.
I call him Popeye because he's got the biggest forearms.
Oh, he's a big dude. Yeah.
I ain't arm wrestling him anytime soon.
I'm not trying to fight him. And
get my technique right first.
And by the way, shout out to LP because, you know, they actually live here in LP.
That's right.
Not far from me and actually on the same street that I used to live on. So
we love LP around here.
You are a sweetheart. And we give a shout out to Eric.
That's right.
Right. Tell him Woody Overton said hello and we'd love to talk to him sometime.
Yeah.
Too, right?
We'd love to.
And,
that's right.
But you've been amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thank you for bringing attention on the case.
Do you have anything
case.
You want to add or take away?
Gator don't play.
Gator don't play. I like it.
Love it. There you go. Make it rain. All right.
Love it. Until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
Complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
Good one.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.